For the week of April 10th, 2011, this is Showbiz Sandbox Episode 99, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, I'm Michael Giltz.
I see you're back in New York.
Yes, I am. Where was I last week?
In New York, but sometimes you're in Libya or Egypt or wherever the hot news is happening.
That's right. Today, the hot news is New York, I guess.
I suppose.
It's the height of the Broadway season, so I'm seeing a lot of Broadway musicals. Every day, every week, there's three or four. So I had a great weekend. I saw three shows. All of them were very good. I saw Catch Me If You Can, a Broadway musical version of the movie, the story done by Steven Spielberg with Leonardo DiCaprio. I seem to be the only person who liked it, but there you go. Then I saw a great immersive version of Macbeth, where it took place in a hotel, and every room was filled with all these elaborate sets, and you wandered through the place whenever and however you wanted, followed any character you wanted. It was just great, done by a London company called Punch Drunk. And I ended up with a family show, Peter and the Star Catcher, a prequel to Peter Pan that was very inventively directed, and it was a lot of fun.
And so you still haven't seen Spider-Man, the musical?
That doesn't open until June, and I'm not going until they give me a free ticket.
So you had free tickets to all of these events? Or all of these shows?
Basically, I paid for Peter and the Star Catcher, actually. But most shows, I am getting access to them in exchange for reviewing.
I see. Well, now, speaking of shows, this show, we're on episode 99, and I've gotten a couple of emails that ask, you know, are we going to do anything special for the 100th episode? And I have to say that if we had been more organized, or actually, if we did anything such as plan ahead, we could have done something special. But in fact, we're not going to be doing anything special other than saying it's episode 100. But maybe we'll do it like on an off episode, like episode 103.
Or maybe we'll keep it under an hour as a special gift to our fans.
Well, yes, I did get a couple of emails last week about our 1 hour and 21 minute show. But that was because we were covering 2 weeks worth of news. We'll try and keep the show a little shorter this week. We're only covering 1 week's worth of news, so it should be possible. We'll say goodbye to Sidney Lumet and talk about the Academy's new leadership. Blockbuster Video was auctioned off to Dish Networks. The Grammy Awards are going on a diet. They seem to be trimming down the number of categories that they will be handing out trophies for. Network news shows are shedding and swapping hosts left and right. Entertainment attorney Jonathan Handel will be joining us a little later on to discuss his new book, Hollywood on Strike, An Industry at War in the Internet Age. It's all about labor disputes in Hollywood. Of course, we always cover all the big entertainment headlines during Big Deal or Big Whoop, or at least those headlines that we remember to put in Big Deal or Big Whoop. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
And the number one movie at the box office this weekend was Rio, the animated film behind Ice.
Whoa. That's not true.
It is true. Rio made $55 million in its opening weekend. It is the number one movie in the world. It grossed more money in its opening weekend than any film has so far this year. It just happens that it hasn't opened in the United States
yet. That's right. Yeah, that's kind of an interesting story, don't you think?
Absolutely. This is the wave of the future. Both Variety and Hollywood Reporter led off their weekend box office reports by saying the number one movie was Rio.
They both said Hop, which is the number one movie in North America.
That's right. Hop right. Was in its second weekend. It grossed $21 million for a $68 million total. But Rio opened overseas to $55 million, a huge opening. It opens this Friday in America. And this really is the wave of the future. I think in 5 years, 10 years at the most, you're not going to worry about whether a movie did well in Brazil or, you know, France or Japan. You just want to know what's the number one movie at the box office. And increasingly, it's going to be something like Avatar or Rio. And you're going to not care whether it opened in the U.S. or not. You're going to say, this is the big movie of the week.
Well, a couple points on that. The reason that films don't open day and date all over the world now are for two reasons. One, logistics. It can be a pain in the neck and very expensive to make all of those prints for all over the world. So you'll have to make 17,000 prints to open a movie like Harry Potter day and date worldwide.
Right.
Also, marketing. The marketing for each territory can be a little different. So, you know, they have to stagger the releases so that they can focus on the marketing for specific territories. And right now, in Asia, for instance, a lot of the English language speaking territories open later because they use prints from the US and UK markets.
But of course, we're getting away from prints. We're going to have more and more digital.
That's right. And that's why I think more and more you'll see day and date releases. It certainly helps stem the tide of piracy.
Right. It stems the tide of piracy. Two, global marketing is just the way to go. You want to, you do everything at once. You get your cast and crew out there. You bring everybody in the world together to interview the cast and the crew, whether it's at Cannes or somewhere else. You get all your press done at once. So yes, I think this is the wave of the future. We're going to be talking about the number one movie at the box office, no matter where it's opened in the world. So in the US, the number one movie at the box office is Hop, as we said before, which grossed $21 million for the Easter-themed animated film. And number two was Arthur, the remake of the classic Dudley Moore Liza Minnelli movie. Check it out if you've never seen it. This remake stars Russell Brand and Helen Mirren, and it grossed a pretty poor $12.6 million, along with disastrous reviews. So look for this to drop heavily and quickly in the weeks to come. At number three is a pretty good surprise, Hannah, from Focus Features, which did quite well. It grossed $12.3 million. At number four is Soul Surfer, another new small independent film. This is about the girl who was a surfer and got her arm bit off by a shark, and within a few months she was back surfing at high competitive levels. It also has a religious theme and was pitched to a lot of religious groups around the country, and it paid off with $11.1 million. And number five is Insidious, the horror film, which cost $1.5 million to make and has already grossed $27 million. So that's a big success story, no matter how you paint it. And number six, another flop in a way, is Your Highness, the stoner Middle Ages comedy that grossed $9.5 million despite starring James Franco and all sorts of other good people.
Natalie Portman, I think, is in that as well, right?
Natalie Portman is in it. It's definitely not done well. It cost $50 million to make. It grossed $9 million. It's going to need great word of mouth or great DVD sales, which certainly is not out of the question in order for this one to turn into a winner.
It just seems like stoner and Middle Ages do not go together.
Well, you've had stoner and caveman, stoner. I think stonerisms work anytime. Bill and Ted traveled throughout history. Don't forget that.
Yeah, so I find it very interesting that people think that James Franco was stoned during the Academy Awards when he hosted, and he's done Your Highness, and he did that. What was the other one that he did where he was a stoner?
Pineapple Express.
Pineapple Express, which, I mean, I saw the movie and I forget the title. That should tell you something about the movie. But, you know, you can see where people would make that connection.
But James Franco, unfortunately, I guess, didn't convince people. He was very funny stoned in Your Highness. At number seven is Source Code, the Jake Gyllenhaal movie, which grossed $9 million. At number eight, the Bradley Cooper film Limitless, which has proven to have quite good legs. It's grossed $64 million total. So that's definitely a success story for him and makes him closer and closer to being a bankable star. And number nine is Diary of a Wimpy Kid, Roderick Rules, which has now grossed $45 million total. Another big win for that franchise. There will be a third one. Number 10, The Lincoln Lawyer, starring Matthew McConaughey. That's at $46 million total, so it's a modest success. And number 11 is Rango, another animated film, the Johnny Depp one. That grossed $117 million. And I'm going to put an asterisk here and say that the number 12 movie of the week is the Metropolitan Opera's production of Rossini's Le Comte Henri, which grossed $2.2 million in 450 locations around the U.S.
Yeah, I'm going to have to write about that for Celluloid Junkie because that's an alternative content event. Of course, the Met has been doing this, I think, for about 5 years now. I'm a huge fan of opera, so I really like these performances. They broadcast them live in HD, and then they usually do an encore performance. But $2.2 million for an alternative content event in 450 locations, that is a huge take. But keep in mind that they're charging, I think, the average ticket price for these events is, I think, $20.
It's $18.50 for your senior and $22 for the next Metropolitan Opera event in the U.S. So I assume it's about $20, $22 per person. Right. They also have kid price tickets, but I doubt there are many of those.
You'd be shocked. A lot of people, because it is during the day, it's during a matinee. So it's usually when theaters on a Saturday are not crowded. They're trying to fill those seats and get some excess capacity taken care of. You'd be shocked at how many kids actually do go.
But this is the rare time when I've seen some actual dollar figures about these events, which take place. They could be, you know, a debate between Glenn Beck and
Stephen Colbert.
No. Glenn Beck and the other Fox Network, Bill O'Reilly. They did a series of tours and did an event like this. It could be anything from a concert, a live concert, to this.
Well, last Tuesday, the Foo Fighters did a live concert, and then it was kind of a taped concert, which is their documentary, and then they did a live concert as well afterwards, or, you know, supposedly billed as a first of its kind.
Right, and you rarely see actual dollar figures about these events, so this is very exciting. In a very slow week, this might have broken into the top 10, or if they played a few more locations or had a much bigger name opera. Rossini's Le Comte Henri is not exactly, you know, Madame Butterfly, So a far more crowd-pleasing show, not that this one wasn't, but one with a big brand name might have pulled in some extra people and broke into the top 10. Now, I'm estimating that because they charge about $22 per person, that means 100,000 people paid to see in the U.S.
That's about right.
They also say another 80,000 people saw the broadcast overseas in 26 countries. That's 180,000 people for one performance. Now, the Met contains 4,000 people, including standing room tickets for any show.
You mean 4,000 seats, because...
4,000 people, because 200 of those are standing room people.
Okay.
So they can hold 4,000 people for any show, and probably at max do about 12 performances of an opera in a season. To get 180,000 people in the Met, you'd have to have 45 sold-out shows at the Met, probably over four seasons. So you're reaching a ton of people who can't physically get to New York City or probably afford a ticket even if they were there. So this is really just an exciting offering.
Yeah, and Peter Gilb, who is the director of the New York Metropolitan Opera, has done a phenomenal job of publicizing these alternative content performances.
Absolutely. So that's the wave of the future. More special content like the Metropolitan Opera, more worldwide grosses instead of being so, you know, parochial and focusing on just North America. I wonder if Sidney Lumet ever directed an opera.
That's a good question. You know, a good question mainly because I don't have an answer to it. And I read a lot about Sidney Lumet over the weekend, so one would think I would have an answer to that question. Unfortunately, the reason I was reading about Sidney Lumet was not because of his storied past. He's the director of 12 Angry Men, Serpico, Dog Day Afternoon, The Verdict, Network, just to name a few. But he passed away at the age of 86 due to lymphoma.
So he was nominated for 4 Academy Awards as Best Director throughout his career. He was nominated for 12 Angry Men, which lost to Bridge on the River Kwai. He was nominated for Dog Day Afternoon, probably his best film, which lost to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. He was nominated for The Verdict, in which he lost to Gandhi. And he was nominated for Network, which he lost to Rocky.
And he lost the adapted screenplay as well for Prince of the City to Ernest Thompson for On Golden Pond.
That's right. He was nominated for Best Director a number of times. His films were sometimes nominated for Best Picture. He never won an actual Oscar, but he did get an honorary Oscar just a few years ago in 2005. When he lost Best Director to Gandhi, he should have lost it to Tootsie or E.T. instead of Gandhi. That's just my own personal opinion, that E.T. and Tootsie are the two best films of that year and deserve to win Best Picture and Director over Gandhi. But that's my own personal opinion. He also made movies like Serpico, Murder on the Orient Express, and River Phoenix's movie Running on Empty.
All great movies.
Yeah, he's made some very good movies.
I mean, the guy has had a stellar career. And what I love now is that, you know, certainly they have a lot of these obituaries pre-written, all the newspapers and all the television, you know, broadcast news networks. But now they begin quoting Twitter. So Spike Lee was on Twitter and he wrote, "Highway robbery of the utmost." And he was talking about, I guess...
how Lumet lost Best Picture to Rocky.
Right, yeah. The network. Yeah, I just think that's hilarious that, you know, they said, Spike Lee tweets, as if somehow tweet is now a replacement for said.
Well, they have to say that because they didn't speak to him. So they have to say that, you know, they're pulling this. It's better to say tweets because they're saying we pulled this off a tweet. And obviously reaching out to actors and writers and people to get a quote about somebody when they died is difficult. If you find that they've tweeted a comment online on their official tweet thing, I think it's a smart thing to do. And of course, Spike Lee's a big fan of Sidney Lumet. He had lots of odes to him in his action film Inside Man.
That's a good movie, actually. That's a good, you know.
Inside Man or Inside Job? I get confused. It's Inside Man.
Inside Man.
Yeah, no, that was a fun film. So there you go. And he was a very gritty New York type of director. Certainly probably would have made more and more independent films if he'd come up today than he did in the past. He was lucky to make major Hollywood movies considering the type of films he made. He probably would have been working a lot with Don Hudson at Film Independent.
Yes, indeed. And I guess the reason you're bringing Don Hudson up, and this is just a strange story. The Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, which is the long name for the people who give out the Oscars each year, AMPAS, they nominated a new CEO. They picked a new CEO. And rather than going with somebody on the inside, I guess everybody thought that Bruce Davis's longtime second-in-command, Rick Robertson, was going to become the new CEO. Instead, he'll be the chief operating officer and will report to Dawn Hudson. Dawn Hudson has been the, I don't know if she's the founder of Film Independent, formerly known as the Independent Feature Project, but she certainly has been running it for the last probably more than 10, 15 years. And of course, they have their own award show the day before the Academy Awards called the Spirit Awards. So she's moving from the Spirit Awards to the Academy Awards.
What's weird about this? I don't know her or Film Independent. I know nothing about them.
Well, it's just, you know, the Spirit Awards were supposed to be an awards in their own right. And so this is being billed as like Dawn Hudson kind of stepping up.
Do you not think she's a good choice to lead the Academy?
Oh, I'm not saying she's a good or a bad choice. What I'm saying is they should be viewed separately.
The Academy Awards have been around for 80 years. It's the most prestigious award in film, obviously. There are a gazillion other awards. Is Dawn Hudson a good choice to lead the Academy? Do you have any opinion on that?
I actually think she probably is a good choice to run the Academy. She certainly turned the Independent Spirit Awards into an institution, and nobody ever seems to have any complaints about them, whereas everybody seems to have complaints about the Academy Awards. She cares a great deal about films, filmmaking, and the art of filmmaking. So, you know what? Rather than a business person or a producer, someone kind of on the inside, it's not bad to have someone like Dawn Hudson show up and lead the Academy, and we'll see what becomes of it.
Great. It probably means smaller filmmakers have a better friend at the Academy, a better voice there than they've had over the years, which is obviously dominated by the studios.
Yes. And, you know, I was reading Deadline, the story on this announcement, and they didn't actually byline it. It just said the Deadline team as the byline. But then in the middle of it, there was a paragraph in the middle of their post. Hudson shared the news she was in contention with only a handful of people from whom she extracted promises not to tell me because she worried it would have totally blown her chances. Wrong, Dawn. I would have helped you get the job sooner because I could have thrown cold water on the only ding against you, that some board members worried you knew a few but not many of the so-called Hollywood movers and shakers, like the major studio moguls and major movie players versus just Fox Searchlight, Sony Picture Classics, and indie producers, etc. And I thought to myself, the Deadline team is the byline and you use the word I and me in this paragraph?
That's a little weird, yeah.
And also very self-congratulatory.
Yeah. I also think it's weird when somebody's being given a position like that and they worry that you won't be able to deal with the big Hollywood studios. It's like, if you're in that position, they're going to want to talk to you and deal with you. It's, you know, if they want to, sometimes they want to hire you to be a top reporter at, say, Hollywood Reporter, and they say, gee, we're worried you don't have the contacts. Guess what? When I call and say I'm calling from the Hollywood Reporter, they're going to answer my call. Same thing. If she's in charge of the Academy and shown she can have good relations with studios and independents, why wouldn't that same skill set work for, you know, Warner Brothers and Disney?
Well, the skill set should work, you know, being able to pick up the phone and get someone on the line. But there is, and this was the same thing with Chris Dodd when he was selected as the head of the Motion Picture Association of America. You kind of need a bit of a politician in there to be able to work things out amongst all of the members, many of whom never agree with one another.
But there's a perfect example of a guy who knew nothing about Hollywood, really.
Right, exactly. But he is very good at
it. She knows a lot about Hollywood and knows some of the players. So what's the problem?
It just then boils down to, can this person act like a politician? So she has the opposite problem.
But that's not the complaint they had. The complaint they had was, we're worried she doesn't know enough of the top people at Disney and Universal and Warner Brothers. And it's like, well, they'll get to know her quick because she'll be in charge of the Academy.
That's true. She'll pick up the phone and they'll return her phone call. End of story.
Yeah. What do you think about the news that Dish Network is acquiring the remains of Blockbuster?
You know, this is, I don't know. This makes some sense and yet no sense at all. I mean, I don't know why anybody would want to buy Blockbuster.
Well, are they getting the property? Maybe it's the land, though I don't think Dish Network is really a real estate company.
No, and they could care less about the real estate deals. Although, at times, when you have a brick and mortar infrastructure like this, that's exactly why certain people bid on companies that are bankrupt.
That's right. Blockbuster was sold to Viacom in the mid-90s for $8.4 billion. And now today, it looks like the Dish Network, the satellite company, will be acquiring the remains of Blockbuster for $320 million. That's a massive, that's about 5%, less than 5% of what it was before.
Yeah, I loved what the managing director, Chris DeMauro, he's the managing director of the investment bank, Houlihan Lokey. I'm pronouncing that right. He advised the creditors who were bidding for the company and said the final result was a mixed bag. I love what he had to say. Our clients were happy that the bidding went up significantly from their $290 million, but they would have liked to have seen it go even higher. Yet, how much higher? It went $30 million higher. It's never going to reach $8.4 billion. So, I don't know, you know, I hate to tell you, it's not going to go to $1 billion.
The one thing that they pointed out that maybe Dish was trying to acquire was, this doesn't make any sense, was the internet business that Blockbuster has developed, because they want to compete with Netflix. And so Dish Network is going to, I don't know, saddle or jump on top of the, whatever internet distribution system Blockbuster has built up, even though it's not very good or well thought of.
Blockbuster has licensing agreements in place with all of the studios, so they can just kind of transfer those licenses. Although very often those licenses won't transfer to a new owner. However, in this case, they probably will, since the studios also have licensing deals with Dish Networks. What they're really hoping to do is stem the tide of people who are saying, you know what, I think I'll cancel my HBO subscription or my premium Dish subscription and just watch all of that content on Netflix instead, since it would be cheaper.
No, that's absolutely true, but I don't know if acquiring the Blockbuster Internet Network is the way to do it, since they didn't seem to have done a very good job themselves.
Right. I just find it amazing that they closed over 1,000 stores this past year. They currently operate 1,751 stores in the U.S. compared to 3,425 stores in 2010. That's remarkable.
The rest are going to collapse soon. I mean, I guess it's sort of like they must have big lunches with the people at Borders and just commiserate over the golden days of the 90s.
Right. Well, you know, some people feel that it's kind of a comeuppance for Blockbuster. When Blockbuster, I guess in the late 80s, early 90s, started infiltrating the market, they put all of the independent video stores out of business. And now Netflix has infiltrated the market and is putting Blockbuster out of business.
Well, that's the way of the world. And the independents wouldn't have survived. Some other chain would have come along to do a better, more efficient job. So, you know, that's how the world works. You know, there's always people cutting and losing out and always people gaining, which is what happened at the Grammys. This week, the Grammy Awards announced that they are cutting about 30 categories from all the awards that they hand out. Most of those, of course, are given out before the TV ceremony that we all watch on television every year.
Well, I think but all of them are, since they only hand out about 5 awards.
I think they handled about 8 or 10. But yeah, you're seeing huge seismic changes in all sorts of areas, like Best Hawaiian Album, Best Native American Album, Tejano, Norteño, all these categories that matter so much to the artists who are involved, but don't get a lot of attention either on air or from mainstream music fans.
Well, they also mean a lot to the independent record labels that release those albums, because they get to promote the artists and the records by saying, a Grammy award-winning artist so-and-so records Hawaiian standards.
Exactly. So it's a sort of a natural thing. What happens is everybody keeps petitioning to add a new category in this area, that area. They want contemporary gospel, classic gospel, gospel rock, gospel soul, gospel hip-hop. And they sort of add more and more categories, and then they step back and say, wait a second, we're splintering everything too much. And they pull back and retract a little bit and sort of try and regain a sense of balance about how many categories they have, so that they can, you know, help fans differentiate between all the music that's coming out.
Right. And we should say that they're not getting rid of those categories. Very often what they're doing is they're just combining all of those categories. So instead of having...
Oh, no, they're getting rid of those categories. You're talking about artists who would... 4 or 5 people would get nominated for Best Hawaiian Album. 4 or 5 people would get nominated for Best Native American Album. 4 or 5 people would get nominated for some other regional folk album. And now they're all going to be competing. Instead of for 20 or 30 slots, they're going to be competing for 5 slots under some title like Best
Roots Music,
Indigenous Folk American Music, whatever right. title they come up with to combine Hawaiian and Native American and Norteño, you know. So yeah, that's going to be combined into just one category with 5 slots rather than 5 categories with 25 slots. So no, they are getting rid of a lot of nomination slots.
Yes. Well, in 1959, they only had 28 categories, which is when the Grammys started.
And they were ignoring a lot of great music.
Right. I would say more than the categories being cut, the two changeovers that are most interesting to me is that they're getting rid of the male and female performers tags. So now male and female performers will just kind of be lumped together in the same categories.
So yeah, pop and rock and R&B, for example, they're just going to say best vocals, whether you're a guy or a girl. And I think that's a healthy change. Too many times you'd see certain categories dominated by oldsters, and there's no reason to make that distinction between men and women necessarily. They don't do it anywhere else. You know, they don't do it in best pop album woman.
Right.
You know, it's not album of the year chick, you know, it's album of the year. And so rock, and you know, there are women who can hold their own with the men in rock, and there are men who can hold their own with the women in pop and gospel. So I think that's a very healthy change.
Well, the other change is kind of more kind of operational in a way. To get 5 nominees in a category, you must receive at least 40 submissions for that specific category. And if you don't receive 40 submissions, if you get like 25 or 39, then you know, I guess between 25 and 39, then you'll only have 3 nominees in that specific category.
Right, sort of like what the Oscars do with the best animated film and some other categories. If you don't have 30, if you don't have 40 albums of Hawaiian music being submitted, then it's a smaller category. If you don't have a certain number of minimum albums submitted, then that category doesn't exist at all.
Right, and if it doesn't exist at all for 3 years, so if it's eliminated because there aren't enough albums to nominate or enough music to nominate 3 years running, then that category gets eliminated entirely.
Right, so it's a way to sort of weed out things. And in this day and age, it's so easy to submit albums and get it done, I think. Well, it's an interesting question because it probably costs a little bit to submit an album to the Grammys. And with more and more people going independent, really independent, I don't mean independent label, I mean putting them out themselves, you could be a very notable proponent of Hawaiian music and have a lot of critical acclaim and not be ready to spend the money to submit an album to the Grammys. And that might mean that category disappears entirely.
So you're saying DIY artists are going to have a tough time.
Yeah, and there can be very legitimate people who just simply say, you know what, I've got my bluegrass label and I just don't want to spend the money to submit it to the Grammys. It doesn't seem like a good, you know, business move for you. But then the danger is that a few years down the road, that whole category could get eliminated. So we'll have to keep an eye on that and see what happens.
Yeah, Neil Portnow, the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences head or chairman, he said that they had been reviewing the Grammy Awards and all of their categories for about 2 years. But there were some critics who said, yeah, and it's interesting that it should come 2-3 months after Stephen Stout, a marketing executive, a music marketing executive to be more exact, ran a full-page advertisement in the New York Times complaining that the awards were out of touch with pop taste. But then he said about these fixes that they were just a Band-Aid.
Well, I don't see these fixes as related to his complaint at all. I mean, his fixes were about voting and about not about categories, but about voting and how winners are selected and saying they're just lame, which was a little bizarre in a year that Arcade Fire was named the best album of the year.
Indeed, and HitFix is asking whether revamping a system that many still feel is antiquated and rewards artists long past their commercial, if not artistic prime, has been achieved through these changes.
Well, that wasn't what they were attempting. They're just saying, look, we got too many diverse categories, too much splintering. We need to tighten it up and clean ship a little bit.
What is
it's not
you
about
splintering?
The voting procedure.
You're you're very woody today. You've said splinter a lot.
Oh. there's a lot of diffusion, too many various and diverse categories, and they're cleaning that up. This has nothing to do with the voting and the, you know, credibility of who actually gets nominated. And I think it'll help fans a little bit, because if you are willing to venture out into a territory like regional music, when you get faced with Tejano and Norteño and something else and Banda, you get a little confused. If those are all combined into one category and you see one winner rather than 4 or 5 winners and 20 or 30 albums, you might be more willing to take a chance on that and say, okay, this is the best of that, you know, whole region of music. And, you know, whether it's Norteño or Tejano or Banda, you might take a shot at it. Whereas when you got 5 options, it's a little confusing.
You know, I was trying to figure out a way as you were talking to use the splintering language in our next story, which is about network news, morning news, news talk shows, you name it. Basically, there's a whole bunch of hosts that are playing musical chairs.
Right. And perhaps the defining reason for all this is Oprah is leaving in May of this year. She is leaving her daytime talk show. It's not the powerhouse it used to be. She's moving to a cable channel, but it is having sort of a seismic ripple effect because everybody else is positioning themselves to see if they can take advantage of the time slot that opens up when Oprah leaves.
And do you think that's really why Katie Couric is leaving CBS Evening News?
Absolutely. She's going to be launching an afternoon talk show. Absolutely. That's exactly why she's doing this. This is the time to do it.
But don't you think it also has to do with the fact that Katie Couric's contract is up? There's been some talk for some time now that she has, you know, really not succeeded in that role as the host of the CBS Evening News.
She's done just fine. The point is, she could have left last year or the year before or next year or the year after, and she's leaving this year because she wants to be poised. This is the perfect time to launch a daytime talk show, and that's what she's thinking of doing. This is exactly why she's acting now. She has a window of opportunity in which to try and take advantage of Oprah's disappearance. Everybody is doing that. Anderson Cooper's launching a talk show. Why? Because Oprah's leaving. Matt Lauer is thinking of leaving the Today Show. Why? Because he might be pairing with Katie Couric on her talk show when his contract goes up at the end of next year.
Yeah, 2012, which I think is very interesting because Jeff Zucker, he of NBC Universal shame or fame, I don't know which word to use there, but he started out as a news producer, wound up pairing Katie Couric and Matt Lauer together on the Today Show, and Katie Couric was very loyal to him. And then he went off and started heading up NBC Universal. She left for CBS. he's now no longer with NBC Universal and is out there on his own. And so is Katie Couric.
That's right. They're going to be working together on her talk show, which launches potentially in the fall of 2012.
So, yeah, I guess Matt Lauer will try and get out of his contract early.
They probably won't let him out early, but his contract ends in December of 2012. We have a lot of people launching shows this fall, like Anderson Cooper. Some of them will fail inevitably because that's how it always works, which means there'll be another wave of opportunity, which again has not been around in 20 years, thanks to Oprah, for other people to launch their show next year. You know,
do you know what I think would be a very good talk show?
What?
If you were to ask me, this is just, you know, and I might be a little biased, but I think a daily entertainment news talk show would really work in that hour.
That's crazy. I have a face made for radio, so you won't see me on TV anytime soon. So we have Katie Couric is definitely leaving CBS News. It's not official. Matt Lauer is making noises about leaving the Today Show. And the idea, just the idea that he might join with Katie Couric has people salivating, I think, in daytime television. Anderson Cooper is launching a show in daytime. He's not leaving his CNN berth. Oprah is leaving for cable. And Glenn Beck is one other person who's on the move. Glenn Beck has been on the Fox News Channel. He still pulls in 2 million viewers a week at 5 p.m., which makes it the third highest rated show of its kind in all of the news cable world.
That's an amazing rating for 5 p.m.
It is. And it's way down from his peak. And advertisers stay away. If you ever watch his show, the first advertiser is like, buy gold. The second one is, the second one is, if you have diabetes. I mean, this is not... He is not pulling in blue chip advertisers, unlike, say, Bill O'Reilly, who really does.
Did you see Jon Stewart's like whole kind of satire of?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he did a great one spoofing him this week, which made me watch his show again. And Glenn Beck was hilarious as always. So, and Meredith Vieira, we forgot about her.
I was going to say, you kind of skipped over that. I didn't know why. But yeah, Meredith Vieira is not, I think she is leaving the Today Show. She basically has given notice, no?
So Meredith Vieira is leaning towards leaving the Today Show. It's not official yet, but it seems likely that she will leave in this September. So you have the evening news shakeup. You have in the morning, the two hosts of the Today Show, the number one show in the morning, and a show that has grossed about $500 million last year for NBC, which isn't a surprise really because it's 26 hours of programming, 4 hours Monday through Friday, and 3 hours on Saturday and Sunday. It provides a ton of programming for NBC, grossed a ton of money, and their two main hosts are possibly leaving. Meredith Vieira almost certainly, and then Lauer next December. So that show means, wow, Good Morning America and CBS are going to be chomping at the bit. At the evening news, ABC and NBC will hope to capitalize on CBS being a little in a weaker position. And in the afternoon, everybody's up in the air because they don't know what's going on. There's just a ton happening.
And if all the people who were talking and writing about all of these moves and these shuffles of the news anchors were actually watching these programs, it wouldn't be an issue. Everybody would just stay where they were because they had successful shows. But instead, we're all talking and writing about them rather than watching them.
I can't remember the last time there were so many musical chairs in so many areas of news and daytime talk. It's unbelievable. And I really think the key reason is Oprah.
So Oprah is the big deal here then?
Absolutely.
Well, okay. That was my poor way.
You don't have to transition. Don't remember. You don't have to transition. It's time for.
Oh, okay. It is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our segment where we discuss the top entertainment news stories of the week, or at least some of them, and whether they are a big deal or if anyone should care about them. Our first story this week, Glee is going gaga in a surprise to absolutely nobody. The TV show Glee is doing an episode on April 26 devoted to the music of Lady Gaga. The show is expanding to 90 minutes, and among other tunes they'll perform, the song Born This Way, while learning a lesson about self-acceptance. Aww. Isn't that show all about self-acceptance? Anyway.
Absolutely.
Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. She is one of the hottest performers around right now. It's cool for the show. I wish they'd get away from their themed episodes where they do one performer. It doesn't work as well. The show works when the songs really matter to the characters. And when you limit yourself to a certain performer, especially a new one without a lot of songs, it's a lot harder to make each song relevant to the cast. So I wish they'd get away from this sort of stunt. It's not necessary anymore. And the show's stronger when they avoid it.
After months of testing and tweaking, YouTube announced Friday that it's rolling out a new live streaming platform for its video partners. With the launch of the new service, which can be viewed at youtube.com/live, YouTube will finally be going up against Ustream, Justin TV, and Livestream, seeking to become the king of live events on the web, according to GigaOM. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. It's a natural extension of what YouTube does. And as long as they can provide a sturdy platform and make it available to as many people as possible, it opens up a lot of exciting possibilities.
Well, it's interesting that you say make it available to as many people as possible. Ustream, Justin TV, Livestream, those are all streaming services that anybody can sign up for, and you can stream, you know, your bedroom, or maybe I shouldn't say bedroom, but your kitchen, or, you know, you reading a book or whatever you want. But YouTube is taking a different approach. They're saying, we're going to roll it out slowly. We're going to go with partners who are on a good standing, approved partners. And usually those are partners with large audiences or premium partners like MTV.
Well, obviously, they're saying if everybody decided to live stream their bedroom, which is fine, they could be sleeping. If they decided to live stream, it would just create an unbelievable, you know, strain on their network, I imagine.
Well, they did an alpha test in September, which was disastrous, apparently.
Well, it was disastrous because the thing froze up?
I don't know whether it was a technology disastrous or just the content wasn't that interesting.
Oh, well, that's a different issue. As long as it worked technically, that's all that mattered.
Speaking of interesting content, George Takei wants to be Spider-Man, and he's letting the world know it. In a goofy online video, the star of the TV classic Star Trek dons the Spidey costume and fights alien bad guys in order to pitch himself as the perfect new star for Broadway's Spider-Man. Turn off the dark. The kicker? Takei jokes that he has great pipes and great insurance. In fact, Takei is coming to Broadway this fall, or in 2012, in a musical called Allegiance, about the shameful act of imprisoning Japanese Americans in internment camps during World War II, the only ethnic group singled out, even though we were also fighting Germans and Italians, to name just two. Is Takei's stunt a big deal or a big whoop?
It's a big whoop, but it shows how inventive you can be to promote whatever you're working on. You know, you latch onto some current phenomenon, and suddenly I know that George Takei is appearing in this new musical, which co-stars Lea Salonga, which I had never heard about before.
Cable channels raised a ruckus when Time Warner offered an iPad app so customers could stream some of their channels onto their iPad while at home and within striking distance of their router. The sky was falling, according to all of these broadcast networks and cable networks. Just a few weeks later, Cablevision is offering a similar app and no one is saying a word. One reason? The service is password protected and offered through their secure digital network and not through the internet. Because otherwise, of course, cable channels imagine people parking in front of strangers' homes so they could illegally stream CNN onto their iPads. Is this non-reaction a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal because it shows, I think, despite the differences, that they're actually getting used to the idea that this is not a big deal, that this is going to happen, and that an iPad is just another TV. It doesn't matter whether you're watching in the TV in the living room or the bedroom or on your computer or your iPad. You're watching programming that you're paying for, and you should be able to do it. And frankly, they should be making it available for you anywhere in the world that you want to log into and do it.
Well, first off, before we get a whole bunch of emails, I know the Time Warner iPad app is password protected and you have to be at home. So
you have to be at home, but it goes through their the internet service rather than apparently some Cablevision digital network. This is what MediaWeek said.
Okay, I'll have to look into that. I think part of the reason that nobody's going up against Cablevision is the last time the industry tried to go up against Cablevision, they lost. And we'll have a little bit more about that at the end of the show in a listener email.
Alrighty.
Oops, she didn't do it again. Britney Spears has been a co-writer on many of her biggest hits, so when her new album popped up and didn't have any songs written or co-written by the pop star, people got a little suspicious. Hitmaker Heather Bright jumped to Britney's defense, in a way, by pointing out that most pop stars demand a co-writing credit on any song that appears on their album, whether they contributed to it or not. So Bright applauded Spears for not making that same demand this time out. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop. It's not really important. I wonder how Britney will react to her defense of Britney Spears. That should be interesting to find out. This is not a new story, of course. Ever since Colonel Tom Parker and Elvis Presley were in charge, Tom Parker would demand every single person, if you want your song on an Elvis album, he gets a co-songwriting credit. That was just de rigueur. That's happened every single time. So this has been going on for a long time in the industry, fair or not. But I did love what Bright said about Justin Bieber. Apparently in some other interview, she was asked how Justin Bieber got a songwriting credit on a song that she did called Somebody to Love. And she sort of laughed and was like, I don't know.
Now, the reason that this happens is because a song kind of has two owners. The recording has an owner, and that's the record label. And the actual lyrics and the musical notes are owned by the publisher. So when a song gets covered or played on the radio, the publisher and the record label gets the record label of that recording gets paid.
I thought actually, if you sing on a song that's on the radio, you don't get a penny.
Actually, you're right. You're right. I apologize. I totally got that wrong. The publisher gets paid. The writers get paid.
Right. That's why it matters, because they want money from when a song is played on the radio. And in fact, there should be new negotiations so that performers do get some cut of songs when they're played on the radio. Why not? I think it's silly that singers don't get a cut as well as writers. I think writers absolutely should, and I don't want to take money away from them, but singers should get reimbursed too. I think it's a reasonable thing.
Britney Spears may not have actually co-written some of the songs she got credit for, but Beatle John Lennon always wrote the letters he signed. John Lennon could hit the charts again, not the music charts, of course, the book charts. The letters of John Lennon are being collected in a book that is due to come out in the fall of 2012. It's being published by Little Brown, complete with the original doodles and drawings he often adorned his letters with. Many, in fact, are reproduced in his handwriting or as typed missives. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, it's a big whoop, but I'm certainly looking forward to it. And, you know, as we all know, he was active in an era when there was no email, so he has a ton of letters to draw upon. So it's not just like letters from him and Yoko, but letters to all sorts of people. And I'm actually really looking forward to reading it.
MTV is finally launching spinoffs from Jersey Shore. One will star DJ Paulie D and the other Snooki and JWoww, all people who I don't really know, though all three are expected to keep appearing on the main series as well. Jersey Shore hit 7.9 million average viewers this season, and the cast will get $100,000 per episode the next time around. Are these spinoffs a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
Well, they're a big deal. They're an obvious extension of the show. I think that's also a sign of the beginning of the end. It's going to be overkill, and everybody's going to get sick of it in a season or two. But I probably would have predicted that. Excuse me. I probably would have predicted that last year, so I could be proven wrong again.
Did you see this story about Snooki versus Toni Morrison? Toni Morrison, of course, being the poet.
Oh, author. Nobel Prize winning author.
Okay.
Yes. No, it made a lot of news all over the world because they both spoke at Rutgers University, and Snooki got paid more money than the Nobel Prize winning Toni Morrison, which is a shonda. It should never occur. Toni Morrison, in a sort of a defense, said she doesn't know who Snooki is. She doesn't care. And she said she gave Rutgers a cut rate on her fee because she used to teach there and has affection for them. But frankly, no college should be paying Snooki to come lecture on anything.
I know. I guess her little nuggets of wisdom were, when you're tan, you feel better about yourself. Study hard, but party harder.
Oh dear, please, let's move on.
The internet made music videos relevant again, and smart bands continue to gain attention by using the web in clever ways. Death Cab for Cutie had a great idea. The new video for their song You Are a Tourist was shot and broadcast live. It features dancers, elaborate sets, and other bold touches for a song that had to come out perfectly in one take. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
It's a big deal because now no other band can claim to be the first one to do this. So they got there first, they did it well, and now it's been done. So you're going to have to come up with some other clever idea to bring attention to your music.
More importantly, everybody knows that Death Cab for Cutie has a new album coming out sometime this year.
Exactly.
Does Jaden Smith, the star of The Karate Kid, see dead people? He might soon. Jaden and his dad, Will, who I believe, if I'm not mistaken, is also a movie star apparently. They are starring in a sci-fi film from director M. Night Shyamalan. In a rare switch, the Philadelphia filmmaker won't be solely in charge. He's writing and directing, of course, as well as producing with Will and Jada Smith, James Lasseter, and Ken Stovitz. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
I think it's a big deal. It's a real chance for Shyamalan to try and regain his mojo and his box office power. Teaming up with Will Smith and his son Jaden and letting them work with him shows that he knows that there's problems here and that he needs to adjust and change the way he's been doing business.
Well, if he's missing his mojo, he might want to ask Mike Myers. I hear he has a lot of mojo, and in fact, one of his films was all about how he lost his mojo and then found it again. One sign that ebooks are catching on is the remarkable success of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo. It appears to be the first book to have sold more than 1 million copies of its digital format. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael? You know what? Never mind. I know your answer to this. Can we just skip to the next one?
It's very much a big deal. It's a sign of the future. It's coming so fast you can't even believe it. I wish there was a website you could go to track ebooks. But anyway.
Before we get a whole bunch of emails about this, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo sold 1 million ebook copies, and yes, authors have sold more than 1 million copies, but not a single title. So
yes, though I wouldn't imagine that many.
I think it's like Stephen King and Stieg Larsson.
Cool.
Just as we predicted, major theater chains have reacted strongly to the major studios planning to release new movies via premium video on demand just 8 weeks after movie's debut. First, Regal and Cinemark said they would cut way back on the trailers they show for the four studios involved: Warner Brothers, Sony, Fox, and Universal. Now AMC says, to heck with the trailers. We want more money. They expect to negotiate different terms for movies that are released this way. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael?
I think it's a big deal. They want more money. They're saying they're playing hardball. They're saying this is a massive change to the way we do business.
Yes, it is a change to the way they do the business. And as we discussed last week, I said that the studios are, I mean, we pretty much covered this in last week's episode. If the studios are going to change the way they deal with exhibitors, exhibitors are going to change the way they deal with distributors.
Right. And we're proven right, because we said, you know what, this is only the beginning.
Actually,
and they're going to want more money.
We're not only proven right, I think they're listening to Showbiz Sandbox.
You may be right.
I think all AMC, Regal, Cinemark, they're all listening to the show and saying, you know what? Sperling and Michael are right. We should negotiate tougher terms. We should charge for showing trailers to films that are going to open on premium video on demand.
Were they saying that Sperling and Michael were right, or were they probably saying Michael and Sperling were right?
I think probably Michael and Sperling, actually, you know.
Let's get on to our last big deal, big whoop.
Our last big deal, big whoop is ad spending, which is showing a comeback, unless, of course, you work at a newspaper or magazine. The Wall Street Journal quotes one firm as saying ad spending should increase 2.5% this year to $155.1 billion. Online shows the biggest growth, increasing by 13%, followed by cable TV at 10%, and cinemas at 6%. Great, more ads at the movies, just what I wanted. Print is hurting across the board, especially at newspapers, which will see ad spending drop by 8.6%. By 2013, they estimate TV will be the number one place for ads, and the internet will be number two. Is this a big deal or a big whoop, Michael, and do I even need to ask?
It's a very big deal. Print is hurting. Obviously, some of that online ads are going to be paid for sites controlled by print publications like the New York Times and the LA Times, like that. But this is a seismic change in where people spend their money to reach customers.
Well, I think you're absolutely right, Michael, and I think given some time, I think you'll see more changes as to where brands and companies will market to reach their customers. I think more and more it will be online. I think online will wind up, maybe not in the next decade or two, but at some point being the number one advertising medium.
Well, actually, I don't think it'll take 20 years because TV and the internet are merging. So the distinction between them will be lost in a little while because so many people will watch TV on the internet. So internet is going to pass simply television, I think, a lot sooner than that. But that wraps up Big Deal, Big Whoop, and it's time for Inside Baseball and our guest, Jonathan Handel.
Yes, Inside Baseball is our weekly segment where we discuss the entertainment news stories that only people in Hollywood might care about.
But now we explain why other people should care about them as well. And this week, we're talking a lot about labor and contract negotiations. They're a constant concern in Hollywood. They're always coming up. It's an almost continuous cycle of dealing with TV actors and movie actors and then directors and then writers and then producers and the tech guilds. It seems like it never ends, where contracts are coming up for renewal and people have to debate and talk about why it's what's important and who's going to get what and who's going to do what and are they going to go on strike. And the person to help us talk about that is Jonathan Handel. He's counsel at the law firm Troy Gold, as well as a contributor to The Hollywood Reporter, and most importantly, a regular guest on Showbiz Sandbox. He's speaking Tuesday night at Southwestern Law School, and he's having a book signing and party on April 30th at the Showbiz store in Los Angeles. It's all to promote his new book out now called Hollywood on Strike, An Industry at War in the Internet Age. It grew out of his coverage of the labor unrest that began in 2007 with the writer's strike and leading to a 100-day strike and turmoil in all the negotiations, really, for the next 2 years. So welcome to the show, Jonathan, and please tell us, why do these strikes keep taking place, and why do they seem to be so intense every 10 or 20 years? What's causing that periodic upheaval?
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you guys. Thanks very much. And as I talk about it in the book, in the prologue to the book, what really seems to happen is that new technologies get introduced perhaps every 10 or 20 years or so. And Hollywood compensation structures are very complicated, specifically the residual structures. And that's what becomes difficult when new technologies introduced, such as the beginnings of internet productions made for the internet, and what some people call move over of television shows and movies onto the internet, say on Netflix streaming, Amazon streaming, iTunes download. Both labor and management kind of furiously attempt to shove this new round peg into either a square or triangular hole. whichever one is best for their side. And of course, round pegs don't fit in squares any better than they fit in triangles. So this is what often leads to concern. On the one hand, we're not going to make enough money, says management, and not making much money now. And the other hand, labor says, you know, you screwed us once, you screwed us twice. We're darned if you're going to do it a third time.
Right. What happens is a new technology comes up, like, say, cable television, and the studios say, hey, this is a new medium. We can't pay you the same amount we've paid you for another form. We're going to have to see how this works out. So take this cut. Take this level of percentage right now. We'll work it out again later. And then DVDs come along and they say, oh, this is a brand new medium. We're not sure how this is going to work out. You know, you can't expect to get the same amount of money you got on VHS. So, you know, take this lower cut rate and then we'll work it out down the road. And so they end up making more money than they should and the actors feel cheated and everybody fights about it. And so every new format creates a new chance for people to try and take advantage one over the other and negotiate and backbite over what sort of cut they get.
Well, your summary is exactly right. And those kinds of negotiations generally don't settle down until the new technology has worked its way through the system, which can take a number of years. So we had the two labor disturbances that you recounted in 2007, 2009. And that's what the book both chronicles and analyzes. You know, why do that? And why read the book? On the one hand, this round of negotiations were relatively quiet. There were no threats of strike or really of stalemate.
Right. Indeed, both SAG and the WGA seem to have reached a deal with producers at this point, and the DGA. So all three parties have now reached a deal.
All three, and actually four, because of AFTRA as well. That's right. And the deals for everyone except the Writers Guild have already been ratified. Writers Guild is out for the next few weeks for ratification. It'll be ratified as well. And the issues there were bread and butter. They were compensation and shoring up the pension and health plans, which are under a lot of stress because of healthcare costs and declining revenues from their investments and so forth. But again, that raises a question, why read the book? And the answer is Silicon Valley is not going to take an Ambien and new technology is not going to go away. Next round and or the round after that, we're going to be dealing with new technologies, both the rise of these existing new technologies and new developments such as the iPad application that Time Warner Cable and Comcast have both deployed. You know, how do you pay residuals on that? Is that television? Is it new media? How does that work?
Well, right now, of course, Time Warner is not paying they're not paying a license to stream onto the iPad, nor is Cablevision. So technically, the content owners, which is who they'd have to cut the license with, are not receiving any additional money. So then the residuals are non-existent.
Because they're saying it's basically just another TV screen. It's like having a TV in the bedroom. It's not a new form of media. It's just another way of watching what they're already paying for and getting ads for.
That's the position that the MSOs, the cable operators, are taking. That's right. And this kind of issue, you have an existing contract, then a new technology comes along, and is it covered by the existing license or not? In this case, the carriage agreements, the agreements between cable companies or between, you know, cable network providers and the companies that operate the cable, physical cable systems, those agreements don't address this technology because it's a new one. The court decisions, I've studied 100 years of this, actually, of these decisions, because even when movies were first invented and people had dramatic rights to books, the right to present live stage plays, there was argument over those licenses. You know, movie is like a stage play. There's actors, people watch them in the theater, watch a movie in the theater. You know, do the existing licenses cover this technology, this new technology of called, you know, motion pictures or flickers or whatever things they call them, or not? And then on and on as technologies like television, cable, DVD, satellite were devised. And now we're seeing this issue in, we saw the issue in new media. Now we're seeing it in new media like the iPad app. Also the rise of Netflix as a content purchaser. The series called House of Cards with Kevin Spacey that is going to premiere on Netflix and is funded by Netflix is a new development. So 3 years from now, we're going to see arguments over that. Now, will there be another strike? There will be sometime. 3 years from now, 6 years from now, who knows exactly. But one thing is a certainty, and that is that as long as Hollywood is unionized, and it's been unionized for 70 to 80 years, you will have these disputes. And the best way to understand the future is to remember the past, and that's what this book is about.
Exactly. I really enjoyed the recap of all the coverage that you got so much attention for about the strikes and the in and outs of what was going on. But what really fascinated me was when you explained why the current system is so flawed for determining and just paying residuals, and then you offered up your solution. So based on your book, I'd like to describe what the problem is, which I only understand because I read your book. And then if you could, you could tell us what your suggested solution is. And basically, the residual system is so flawed because first, you have so many formulas. There's a different formula for every guild and every medium out there, from TV to cable to streaming internet to DVD to you name it. And everybody, from the actors, the writers, the directors, the producers, they've all got their own formula. And then it varies sometimes from studio to studio. It's just a nightmare. And it's also just incredibly expensive and time consuming to monitor all those sorts of different media and which one is making how much money in what format and when. But then the real crazy thing that you told me was about mailing checks and getting them out to people and how antiquated it is. Basically, a studio will cut a physical check for a residual amount and mail it to the guild for that person, say a writer. Then the writing guild takes that physical check, deposits it, waits for it to clear, and then they cut another check and they send it probably to the person's agent. That check goes to the agent who gets it, waits for it to clear, deposits it and all that. When it clears, he takes his cut and then he cuts another check and sends that to the actor. And then the actor gets their check in the mail for perhaps 11 cents and then deposits it and waits to get access to the 11 cent residual he got for a TV episode he did 17 years ago. It's just incredibly time consuming and silly and crazy. And it's a lot of effort.
For very little upside.
Well, that's right. Your summary, again, of what I discuss in the book, and the book is Hollywood on Strike, an Industry at War in the Internet Age, is correct. And if you go to my blog, jhandel.com, jhandel.com, you'll find several things. One, we mentioned the two events on April 12th and April 30th. You'll find a blog posting with links to RSVP. The events are free. RSVP is requested. You'll also find links to buy the book. Don't forget those. On Amazon, in paperback, and Kindle. But what you'll also find that is directly to the issue you just raised is a residual summary chart, also available on a T-shirt, because it looks so colorful and ridiculous that I had to put it on a T-shirt. There are about 8 or 10 different colors in this chart representing different kinds of formulas. The formulas do vary in the ways you discussed. The new media formulas increase the number of formulas and the complexity by almost 50%. The chart would be significantly smaller without new media, even though new media is generally bringing pennies or maybe nickels these days, not dollars. And the proposal that I make in the postscript to the book, Hollywood on Strike, is to scrap these various residual formulas, which are dozens and dozens of formulas. They differ, you know, among deals that have been cut individually. They sometimes differ among studios, not so often actually, but they do differ amongst guilds. And among media, did you make something for theatrical, then you released it on DVD, that's one formula. You released it on television, that's another formula. You took a TV show and released it on DVD, or you had primetime reruns, that's several more formulas, et cetera. Is to scrap all of that, and my proposed solution is to simply add up all the revenue that the studios get from a given project, whether it's theatrical or made for television, made for home video, or new media, any combination of the above, and then take a percentage of that, and that's the residual.
Now, this is so simple and clear, and it's so future protected, meaning if you come up with 3D holograms or some other way of revenue streaming down the road that you haven't anticipated, it's all right. It all goes into the same pile. It's so easy to understand. I can't imagine Hollywood ever adapting it because it makes too much sense. And it's absolutely perfect because actors don't really care whether you make a dollar at the box office or on DVD or video streaming or from Redbox or in an airplane or whatever it may be. Nobody should care if a movie makes X amount of dollars from any format or any way that they can, that should go into the pool and then you get your cut. You know, I'm tempted to think people won't accept it, but it really does make a lot of sense. Has there been any positive feedback?
Everyone says it's a great idea and everyone says it'll never happen. I mean,
well, think about it. I mean, right now you've got, if you go with a simple idea like this, that actually decreases the number of times the studios have to go back to the writers, actors, directors, all the creatives, and win another battle, because slowly over the last 20, 30 years, they've chipped away at residuals to the point where now for new media, they're so small and the revenues for new media and streaming are so small that it's not even worth it. More and more as we subscribe rather than buy our content, that formulas such as this will have to be adopted.
Well, I think it makes an awful lot of sense. I mean, what's going on here and why there's so many formulas is, of course, that the business models for each of these media, existing and new media, varies. And so a formula tends to be put in place that bears some relation to the existing business model. But this structure where each particular brick makes sense, you know, you put one brick here, you put a cinder block there, you put drywall here, what you end up with is a structure overall that, you know, that teeters on the brink of chaos, really lives in chaos, and it causes these strikes that cause management and labor to lose so much money. And when that happens, you have to step back a step and say, you may have had reasons for using, you know, one formula here, or a different formula there, and on, but why not scrap the thing and build something that makes sense from the ground up? That's something that's very hard to do in labor relations, and it just hasn't happened.
And if you want to know more information about this, your book, Hollywood on Strike, An Industry at War in the Internet Age, as you mentioned, can be purchased on Amazon. Certainly, I appreciate you being here. I'm sure Michael, I'm speaking for Michael. But
And we'll have links to your website, Digital Media Law and JonathanHandel.com. And people can find out more information about all your appearances and links for the book.
Well, thanks. Again, the website is jhandel.com, jhandel.com. The book, which I've enjoyed writing and I'm already getting feedback that people have enjoyed reading, is Hollywood on Strike.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Talk to you soon.
Okay, talk to you soon, guys.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, I do think his proposal makes so much sense, and it's something that I always say, look at the big picture. When you're talking about whether a movie's a flop, people like the first weekend, or they compare the Hollywood weekend to this weekend last year or last weekend. And if you look at the big picture, which is what I always encourage, you know, you calm down a bit. It doesn't matter whether the movie makes it money at the box office or the first weekend or the fifth or on DVD. What matters is how much it costs to make and how much it ultimately grosses in all the different areas they can make money.
Right, but what I was trying to point out in my last question and or statement there, I can't remember whether it was a question or a statement, was that, you know, the studios love the fact that it's so complicated because that makes it harder to track the money and easier to shift revenue around from one format to another.
Right, and that's why they don't talk about how much movies make on DVD, because they don't want people to know how much of my money they were making for all these years, because they were afraid actors would demand a higher residual, because they initially conned them into taking a lower residual, just like record labels did with compact discs. They said, oh my God, this isn't going to work. We can't possibly pay. Not only are we charging more for the albums, but we're going to give you less of a residual. And that worked for years until everybody screamed and yelled and they had to fight over. But this is the way to go in the future. You shouldn't worry about where and how you make the money. It simplifies everything for everybody. I think it would be good for the studios. It would lower lawsuits. It would lower complexity in just getting the money to people. I think it's a great idea.
So you're saying the lawyers that would ultimately have to defend and or fight those lawsuits, they're the ones that are creating the contracts, which, I mean, it's basically job protection.
Perhaps, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you know where I was going with that. Yeah. But speaking of job protection, we should probably move on to listener email because apparently a few people had some problems with last week's episode.
I'll take the first email. This is from one reader tired of lengthy podcasts. He says, hey, kids, the podcast was 1 hour and 21 minutes this week. That's longer than each of the last two Manuel de Oliveira films. Which is a hilarious comparison, since Oliveira is like the 99 or 103 year old. I forget how old he is now.
I think he's actually 100 now, isn't he?
Yeah, he's very old and he's still making movies. And his last two films were, in fact, more succinct than our last podcast. But it was covering 2 weeks, so they really were two 40-minute podcasts.
That's right. That's the way you look at it. We produced two of our shortest podcasts, just merged them together.
Why don't you read the other email to us?
Okay. It starts off, hey kids, just a quick follow-up to your story on streaming video services. You mentioned a company called Zadiva, which rents movies via DVD, but does it remotely. They contend the first sale doctrine gives them the ability to purchase DVDs, put them in DVD players in a data center, and stream them from these remote DVD players into homes. The MPAA, the Motion Picture Association of America, representing the studios, believes otherwise, and sued Zadiva, last week, trying to get an injunction to shut the company down. However, the MPAA may have, that's hard to say, however, the MPAA may have a tough road ahead. Back in 2008, U.S. courts approved Cablevision's RS DVRs. These are remote storage DVRs, which allow cable subscribers to record television programs on a DVR at the cable operator's facilities and then stream them back into the home. So it's kind of like cloud storage. The suit alleged that cable operators were actually broadcasting the content into homes, but courts disagreed. It will be interesting to see if this legal ruling makes it difficult for the MPAA's own suit. Great show. Keep up all the good work you're doing. Damon Roberts.
Well, you know, that's a great comparison. I wish I'd made it at the time because I remember that case very well. And I thought, why would the studios care whether the DVR is in someone's house or at the cable company? All that does is allow them to provide more storage to more people and make it easier for them to watch the TV shows they're already selling them. And that's a very good comparison. But I think this business model is silly no matter what. You know, this is a Divas model.
However, our business model here at Showbiz Sandbox is rather simple, much like Jonathan Handel's solution for residuals on an ongoing basis. And it's not that complex. It's free. You can subscribe to our show in iTunes or the Zune Marketplace or even your RSS reader. You can find those links and links to all of our social networking accounts and links to all of the stories we've talked about on today's episode, as well as all of our past episodes. All of that information can be found in one place. I mean, this must be an amazing place. It's our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find ways to contact us. You can email us, dirt@showbizsandbox.com is the email address to send off your missives to, or you can call us. The toll-free number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by MGMT, the popular indie rock group, who can be found on MySpace or on their own website, who is mgmt.com. Michael has a website. His website is michaelgiltz.com. At Michael Giltz is his username on Twitter. I'd like to thank Jonathan Handel for joining us today. We'll place links to all of his work in our show notes. I'm on Twitter. My Twitter name is @Sperling, and you can find some of my writing on Celluloid Junkie. Until next week, play nice.